What you want to do is destroy this guy's life, hold this seat open, and hope you win in 2020. You've said that.
That was a very impassioned Lindsey Graham from the Senate Judiciary Committee hearings at the Kavanaugh confirmation, which took place, it seems like, a long time ago. But it actually wasn't that long ago, and it is the subject of a brand new book, the hottest book in America as we sit and have this conversation right now. Number one on Amazon, Justice on Trial, The Kavanaugh Confirmation, and the Future of the Supreme Court. Molly Hemingway, Carrie Severino, Regnery Publishing, our sister organization. I always want to strongly recommend what they are doing. But ladies, it is such an honor to have you in studio with us. Thank you for being here. And Molly, I'm just going to fan geek for a second here, because your work all through the Russia investigation, there were three people, I told my listeners every day, if you want to know what's going on with Russia, you read three people, and these are the only three people you need to read. Byron York at The Examiner, Kim Strassel at The Journal, and Molly Hemingway at The Federalist. And I don't know how the three of you got all the scoops that you had, and I don't know who all your sources were, but the way you were ahead of the curve on every single thing at every stage of that story was just, it was a public service to the nation. I just wanted to say thanks.
Thank you. I appreciate it. And it was one of those things where reporters should have been able to tell that there were problems with this conspiracy theory that was out there, and it. But I'm glad that a few of us were able to stand up against
it. You actually helped, I think, talk radio do something that we kind of excel at, and that is tell the other side of the story, but do it in a way that was really powerful. And Carrie, similar congratulations to your organization for the duration of the Kavanaugh trial, because I know that we had you on at least a couple of times, and some of your colleagues, but you were fact-checking all the details of the story, and I'm sure a lot of that went into the new book. But I'm in the shadows of greatness today. This is just so cool to have both of you here. Let's talk about how the book came about. Whose idea was it? Where did it come from? Did you guys just have coffee one day and say, man, we know a lot about this. We should put it all down on paper.
This is one of the most important things that happened to the country last year, right? As our title indicates, it wasn't just Kavanaugh on trial. It was really justice on trial, the whole notion of due process. And Molly and I felt like we would be the perfect team to tell that story. I worked for Justice Thomas. We've seen this playbook before, where they try to make these allegations against someone, and then later on, it's not over just because he's on the court. They go back, and it's revisionist history time and again, and they've done that with Justice Thomas. We went from 2-1 Americans believing him over Hill to flipping that, and I think that we didn't want them to do that with Kavanaugh. We thought the best way would be to tell the real story. So you've got an excellent investigative journalist over here. You've got someone who knows the Supreme Court, and it's turned out to be a great team for really getting those facts out there, because that's what's going to help prevent it happening again.
And it was important not just to go through the confirmation, but to make sure that the facts got out afterwards. We knew that there were liberal activist reporters who were preparing books to kind of re-go through these issues without telling the facts. We had access to all the key players, and we knew that they had really interesting stories to tell, and so we just decided to go for it.
And we thought we knew a lot going in. Boy, did we learn some amazing stuff. I mean, we were living this, but we learned so much more in the process of talking to this 100 and more people, the Supreme Court justices, senators, the president, you know, all these people in the White House. It was amazing.
That's what I've picked up on in just the limited amount of media you've done since the book has come out. I'm guessing that all that behind the scenes access also has revealed some things about where we stand since the hearing. And I want to come back to like the process of the book, but I think for the listeners, like most newsworthy kind of interest, there were a number of things that coming out of the hearing, Lindsey Graham becoming the head of the Judiciary Committee, promising to use his investigatory powers in a more complete way. What's been the progress of the wrongdoers in the Kavanaugh confirmation since that time?
Well, it is very important that you not let people make false allegations without holding them accountable. And the previous chairman of the Judiciary Committee, Charles Grassley from Iowa, who is such a stalwart when it comes to victims and whistleblowers, he knows it's important to not make false accusations. So he actually did a criminal referral for several of the people who made false accusations, including Michael Avenatti and Julie Swetnick, who had made the outrageous gang rape.
Going up the creek for a bunch of things.
He's got bigger issues than this. Take a number.
But one of the things that is so troubling is that a lot of these allegations were vague. You know, there was no specificity. It is very hard to defend yourself against a vague allegation, but it's also hard to prosecute someone for making a false claim when it's a vague allegation, which is why it's one of the things that's helpful about having a book-length thing, and we go through it in Justice on Trial, the coordination between the different leftist groups and how they worked with senators and how they paid protesters to kind of create this circus climate and all the different interesting connections between the people who are involved. There are processes that we have in this country for how to make allegations and how to litigate those, and the Senate has processes that were developed after Clarence Thomas's after his ordeal, and Senator Dianne Feinstein rather noticeably avoided those processes, even though they are, you know, all agreed upon. Instead of talking to the FBI or going through the normal Senate procedure, she called a Democratic activist attorney, and they put together, you know, a PR
a game
campaign.
Plan. Yeah.
That's not how you normally handle something if you actually care about victims.
Mm-hmm. Carrie, let me ask you this. There was much debate during the actual hearings, and those two or three days seemed to just go on forever. It seemed like weeks of television time.
Yep.
But one of the things that was kind of written as a narrative in some of the mainstream media was that Blasey Ford was totally believable and that women across the country believed her. Now, I knew something different in my own household. My bride, who is 10 years younger than me and 10 times smarter than me, looked at her in a matter of seconds and said, I don't know. That's just, you know, it's just not connecting. In your research for the book, did you find any examples of how women may have departed from what the national narrative was in terms of coming to Blasey Ford's side?
Sure. Yeah, and one of the most exciting ones to learn about was Melania Trump, who told her husband and said, you know that woman's lying, right? I mean, she had that instinct and just said, and it's interesting because you're right, it's millions of women across the country who had that reaction and were just saying, you know, this doesn't add up. And it's another area where, you know, Rachel Mitchell, I don't think, got a lot of credit for the work that she did. She was the one who was the prosecutor from Arizona who was hired to do that questioning. And it was really interesting when you look at the facts she was able to uncover. She wasn't a bulldog who was jumping down her throat, but she uncovered a lot of really significant things there. For example, Blasey Ford had been trying to put off that hearing by saying, her lawyers are saying, well, she's afraid to fly. She can't get out from California. Like, she's going to walk or something. It turns out, you know, she just would ask her one question after another. How'd you get here? Oh, well, I flew. You know, so you do fly? Well, sometimes I have to. I didn't want to have to do it. Oh, do you fly for work? Yeah. You know, and she kind of, and then it comes out eventually, well, actually, she's an avid surf tourists. So she's been to, you know, Tahiti,
Hawaii,
New
the
Zealand,
Philippines, yeah.
Places you don't have, there's no train there. Right. There's no highway there. She has flown all the time. So it's things like that where you start picking apart and going, now, wait a minute, you're lying to us about other things here. What's going on here?
So will the historical consensus be that the independent prosecutor that the Republicans hired was a stroke of genius, Molly?
Well, you know, this was one of the things that was most interesting for us. And we did speak with Rachel Mitchell. She's this really just a very responsible woman who has a real life in Arizona teaching people how to question victims of sexual abuse. She cares about
which is
work.
A sensitive thing.
She's considered the nation's best, and she teaches people how to do this, and teaches people because you're frequently dealing with child victims and whatnot. And so she cares about her work. She cares about being proper. She cares about putting the best construction on things. And I think a lot of people in D.C. they wanted someone to just go for the jugular. She has to go back to her normal job and be well respected. And she did actually, if you were paying attention, she did such a good job, and it ended up being a really important thing for the senators themselves. When she makes the case to them about how she would handle this, you know, she is a prosecutor, she said, there's not even enough here for a search warrant. There's certainly not enough here for
right.
a conviction. And that was very helpful for a lot of senators who weren't sure how seriously to take these things. They end up, she did such solid work and such a solid report, the senators actually gave her a standing ovation in their private meeting.
Well, well deserved. Justice on Trial is the name of the book. The Kavanaugh Confirmation and the Future of the Supreme Court. Molly Hemingway and Carrie Severino are my special guests. Ladies, we remember one other personality rather largely in this whole debacle, and that was Jeff Flake. How does history look at him, treat him, deal with him now?
Yeah, out of all the fun stories we learned, the story of what was going on, remember that day when he kind of went from going saying, I'm going to vote for Kavanaugh, to going off out of the Judiciary Committee hearing into this back room and then coming out and saying, nope, I'm not going to vote until the FBI has an investigation. Now, on one hand, actually, ironically, at the time, everyone was frustrated with that. I think, actually, it ended up only helping Kavanaugh, because what the investigation turned up is not just there is no additional evidence here, but actually a lot of things that raised questions in the senators' minds of this looks even less plausible.
Including witness tampering.
Witness tampering. But we talked to so many people who were in that room, and boy, it was dozens of people in this small room off of the Senate. It was such a circus-like atmosphere. You had Senator Coons, who was the main Democrat, trying to lobby him. Senator Flake shoved into, these are both tall men, shoved into a small phone booth. Everyone else trying to lobby Flake, trying to fit themselves into this phone booth. People are shouting. Senators yelling at each other, almost coming to blows. This is so out of the norm of what happens in the Senate. And some other senators really being frustrated because they felt like there were instances where Senate staff was undermining their own senators' interests. So the politics going on in that back room were just crazy. It just is in a microcosm of this whole circus-like process.
So was the setup was the final determination in your investigation that this was entirely a foreplanned attempted takedown? I mean, starting with Feinstein and her staff and kind of organizing, and then you had the other stories that kind of came in and tried to lob on top of that, but none of them were successful. But was it something that kind of organically developed and then fell apart? Or was this from the beginning a missile
We have our own thoughts, and I think people will read it and develop their own thoughts about how coordinated this is. But there's no question that there was coordination from the very beginning, before Kavanaugh is even named.
Who paid for the lie detector test?
Right. Well, that. But you actually
did we ever get an answer to that?
It does seem interesting that there were things that were happening even from the get-go. The radical pro-abortion groups start trying to paint him as a frat boy, and they start highlighting his laughter or something like
that. Back in
July.
Which
is the thing that comes out when you even have the first story coming out in the Washington Post. You could see that if it weren't a well-developed, coordinated public relations plan, it had all the markings of one. And like you point out, instead of going to the FBI, instead of going through the normal Senate procedure, they bring on this well-known Democratic PR firm type attorney, and she pays for a polygraph. That's just not normal behavior. If you wanted to keep something secret, your first call wouldn't be to the Washington Post.
Right.
If you wanted to keep something secret, you wouldn't break the news in the Washington Post. You would tell the Senate Judiciary Committee.
Or the FBI, whose job is to do these things confidentially. That's
right.
That's not what they did.
And yeah, so it was something that certainly a lot of Republican senators, both on that committee and just people whose votes were needed, felt that it was complete political gamesmanship, and that's why they didn't take it as the same way that so many people in the media did, who had no questions, even though they should have had a lot of questions. I mean, we learned from our reporting that Christine Blasey Ford was well known in the D.C. community. She had a very different reputation than what the Washington Post put out there in their hagiographies. Her friends, who actually like her, say that she was a heavy drinker who was very aggressive with boys, much more aggressive than they were. That didn't come out, even though the media knew this. And we also have evidence that they knew some quite more salacious stories that they, hid and covered up, the exact opposite of how they were being. And so how they were being with Kavanaugh, that level of coordination between the media, Democratic partisans, these big, high-powered PR firms and law firms, and even that they paid for protesters to come out, which mm-hmm. they admitted. And we have in our, we have the evidence.
Were those the people that were kicked out of the hearing on consecutive days?
They were brought in, and they also
were trained in how to get kicked out and how to get arrested, because that was their goal. They were paid, their bail was paid for, their flights were paid for, their legal training was paid for. It was a real organization.
Okay, so this is a compelling, not only reason to get the book, Justice on Trial, The Kavanaugh Confirmation and the Future of the Supreme Court. Hemingway and Severino are the authors. But I want to kind of draw some practical application to right now. Will this confirmation play a role in 2020? How does it play with women? I think in particular, and I tend to be, I'm a dad, three kids. My daughter is my youngest. I am a very sensitive, ape when it comes to this stuff. I sat there and watched Judge Kavanaugh have to fight back the tears to get his opening statement out. And even more heartbreaking to me than that was to watch Mrs. Kavanaugh sit behind him within camera view and to see what it was doing to her. And it just just ripped my heart out. And I'm thinking, how can the nation do this to these people who, by whatever he was like in high school or college, by the time he hit the circuit as a judge, his reputation from that point on was spotless. So I have a hard time believing that. I mean, maybe you've got rebellious youth issues, whatever, but he wasn't a rapist. He wasn't what they were calling him. And his daughters were witnessing this. His wife is witnessing this. How does that impact what women saw, how they think, and where their minds are going to be, if at all, in the 2020 question?
Well, we know from just looking at 2016 how important the courts were. You know, a quarter of Americans said that was – a quarter of Trump voters said that's why they did this. A fifth of Americans said that was the number one reason they went to the polls. So I think it's only increasing the awareness of people of the significance of this issue. And I think the biggest concern I have, you know, as you point out, you've got this family who's going through this. Ashley Kavanaugh, we learned – and tell the story of how she didn't even want her husband to get this nomination in the first place, yeah, because they had already been through two very controversial confirmation processes from his previous appointment. So she's praying literally, please, like, let this cut pass. I do not want him to have to go through this again. And then has to be this pillar of strength for her own family going through the process. If this is what happened last time, who's going to want to take another job like this? What is this going to say for the next men and women who we want our most qualified people to be our public, right, servants on the court? I think that's a real concern. That's why we wrote Justice on Trial. We want to make sure America knows what happened so we can be aware and not allow it to happen again.
But it was one of those things, too, that really was frustrating to watch in the media coverage, where they would portray this as if women thought that allegations without evidence should always be believed, when in fact many women, I mean, women are not a monolith, and many, if not most of us, love men. We're married to them. We have sons. We have fathers, uncles, brothers, and we care about them not being accused without evidence and having their lives destroyed. And it is something that I think people were surprised to find out that, you know, you mentioned that your wife had this feeling that she was lying. In general, we would talk to men and they would just take it very seriously. And the women we were talking to would say, well, we have problems with this story for this, that, or the other reason. And it is important because we care about sexual assault and because we care about violation of women that we keep our standards for, yeah, how to handle allegations, so that when women do have, when they are victims, that they are believed when they have the evidence to support it.
Well, isn't the solution to a lot of society's ills good men becoming better? Like, isn't the cultivating of better men in our society something that we want to, like, constantly champion and say, bring to the fore? And when you tear down someone who is innocent and is good, that is, I just think it's damaging on a lot of different levels that we're already having problems with in terms of fatherlessness, et cetera.
That reminds me of something. You were saying that maybe Brett Kavanaugh had a rebellious youth or whatnot. We interviewed quite a few people who knew him in high school, college, and whatnot. And he has already testified that he liked to drink. But his friends actually reported that he was the nicest man,
right,
the nicest young man. That they're, you know, he had a lot of female friends who loved being with him. And it was his treatment of women over the course of his life ended up being a godsend for him, because he had dozens of women who were willing to, at great sacrifice, because the media environment, yeah, was so crazy at that time, get out there and publicly risk their own reputations and whatnot to defend him because of how he'd lived his,
well,
life.
Well, on social
media,
it's
actually a testament to how he...
You had, yeah, all those groups that came forward, you know, yeah, Women for Kavanaugh, et cetera. Last question. You got to talk to the president about all of this. How on God's green earth did he not touch Twitter over those 3 days?
Yeah, I think at the beginning of the confirmation, he was much more restrained. But I think what was also interesting is when he did eventually come back on Twitter. And I think a lot of people agreed that there was a moment where he started saying, you know, there are some issues with the way that she's brought these allegations out. Now, the way he talked about it may not be the style that a lot of people did, but I think it was a moment that he was really tapping into what a lot of Americans were thinking, which is, wait a minute, am I allowed to actually comment on all the obvious? It's like the elephant in the room. Everyone's going, there's,
right,
red flags here. We're not, right, talking about them. And he did.
Well, we interviewed the president, but we also interviewed a lot of other people in the White House. And one of the things that I thought was interesting to learn, and we did.
They were hiding his phone. No, they were just putting it under potted plants
you think,
all over the
you
place.
You have this view of the Twitter as just completely his, you know, id out there on display. But in fact, they do coordinate his Twitter messaging and they do talk about it. And so we had talked with people who were saying it was part of their strategy to hold off on Twitter. And then at some point they themselves say, let it rip, like, let it go. This is getting ridiculous. And so it wasn't just that you had that initial vague allegation, but you're starting to get just the craziest claims,
right,
you know,
boats
in Delaware and, you know, a like a nationwide crime spree.
Some of those people are going to jail, right?
Well, they've been criminally referred, but our Department of Justice apparently has different priorities about what it's engaged in right now. But we do tell all these stories in Justice on Trial about how the White House was operating, what they were thinking, and when the president decides that enough is enough. And he doesn't just do that in that speech and on Twitter. I thought it was also really important that after the confirmation was over and he and Justice Kavanaugh is being sworn in the White House, he apologizes on behalf of America. Mm-hmm. And we learned that Justice Thomas was one of the loudest applauders at that line because he knew what this was like
Absolutely.
To go through in a way few other people did.
Well, all we have to do is keep treating our public servants like this, and pretty soon you're not going to have anybody wanting to serve anymore. Mm-hmm. So, ladies, as you do in your daily reporting and activism, you have done the nation a service, and the grateful nation says thanks. Thanks for stopping by.
Thank you so much.